I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is women's hockey. We are just over 2 weeks away from the kickoff of season two of the PWHL, which was a big success in its inaugural season last year. But the league's success did not happen in isolation. It was and is the product of a long effort by women across multiple generations for a professional league, for the legitimization of women's hockey, which for a long time was confronted with significant headwinds from people not taking the sport seriously, to struggles to find ice time and equipment, and a constant battle for recognition in terms of how great these athletes truly are. And you can go back in the sport's history from significant events like the introduction of women's hockey into the Olympic Games in 1998, the first World Championship earlier in the decade, back to some very important historical figures looking at the Preston Rivulets, for example. The history of women's hockey is filled with incredible athletes who were also pushing hard for greater recognition off of the ice. And that is the subject of a new book by Ian Kennedy entitled Ice in Their Veins, Women's Relentless Pursuit of the Puck, in which Ian, who is a sports writer, goes through the history of women's hockey back from those early days of the sport professionalizing in the 1920s up into the drop of the puck of the PWHL last year. And the book uses both archival sources as well as interviews with women who are active players, but retired players as well, about their stories, about what they went through competing on the ice and really challenging conventions and challenging and overcoming barriers off of the ice. It's a wonderful profile. It's a wonderful book put together by someone who clearly has a great passion for hockey. And while he is not a historian in the true sense of the word, his journalistic instincts come through very well. And he's a great storyteller, and the book just flows very nicely. So I was very pleased when I had the opportunity to speak with Ian. I think you'll very much enjoy the conversation as well. So let's get right into my chat with Ian Kennedy. All right. And Ian Kennedy joins me now. Ian, how are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming back to talk about Ice in Their Veins. As I said in the intro, obviously it's a look at women's hockey and the history of women's hockey. So we had you on about a little over a year ago to talk about your previous book. So what was then the impetus to do this particular book? And I would imagine when we talked last year, this was well underway, this project, given that it's already out and out there for the public. So what was the impetus to want to go back and do this really deep historical dive into women's hockey?
Well, actually, the beginning of it all started while I was researching for On Account of Darkness, looking through some of the old historic women's hockey tournaments and things like that. And I found a picture and a story about a woman named Marion Coveney, who was from my hometown in Wallaceburg, Ontario. And I didn't really know anything about her, but, you know, she appeared in a lot of the news articles at the time. I think I was interviewing or researching Angela James, who, of course, is in the Hockey Hall of Fame, one of the very first Black women to make a really big splash with Canada's national team. And anyways, Marion turned out to be Canada's first ever national team captain from a team in 1987. And I had no idea that she existed, even though we were from the same hometown. And it came to be that, you know, I thought that if I didn't know about her, there was probably many incredible athletes that I had no idea about, and recognized that had Marion Coveney been a man, our local arena would have been named after her. We would have had a sign entering our town about her. She probably would have been in the Hockey Hall of Fame, but none of that existed. And so I started researching her and talking to people and interviewing people about Mern, as she was called by everyone. And, you know, one thing leads to another. You're down a rabbit hole of research. And as soon as you talk to one person, they suggest three other people you should speak to. And pretty soon I had not just her story, but a plethora of really what I thought were important, unheralded, not explored people that should have been known by the history world, the hockey world, because I think when we talk about men's hockey or when we talk about hockey history, we're really referring to men's hockey because women's hockey history has not really been researched or studied, or there's really not an in-depth catalog of statistics or dates or facts. It's all over the place. You might find snippets of it here and there, but there really was nothing comprehensive. And so this was an attempt at doing that. It definitely was not comprehensive. I probably could have added 10,000 more pages, but nobody reads a 10,000 page book. So we stopped, you know, in the normal book range.
Yes, it is. Yes. If anyone is scared that, yes, it is a normal size book when you pick it up. I am curious though, because one of the things that comes up all the time, and anyone who has taught undergraduate history or even potentially high school history, I don't know, I've never done that, but those of us who have had the opportunity to teach history, is we talk a lot about don't get too attached to the archives, too attached to the documents, just in the sense that what's there can be great and what's there can be very good, but also keep in mind there's a lot that's not there or a lot that wasn't written down. And when you're looking at the history of women's hockey, and as you said, it hasn't really been studied a lot, I would imagine there's not that much of an archival record to go on. Now, you are a journalist by trade, so you know how to go back into newspaper articles and other sources in that regard. But from a methodological perspective, I'm very curious as to how you went about this and tried to find history, especially the older stuff that you write about, where there might not be that living memory.
That was very problematic. probably the farthest back I could stretch was people that played in the 1960s and 70s regularly. Beyond that, of course, we've lost a lot of the people that had oral history and could have shared that knowledge. So, and I do believe that a lot of this history is still uncovered in women's hockey history. Most of it probably lives in local museums and small libraries where the microfiche hasn't been digitized yet, and it's not out there for general public, and you'd have to visit town by town by town to really get a sense of a comprehensive history. But there are a lot of great resources online. I spent a lot of time at libraries and museums. The Hockey Hall of Fame was a great help whenever I asked for parts of their collection that they had. And in general, whenever I did reach out to someone in the women's hockey world, they were happy to either mail me their entire scrapbooks, their personal journals, all of the photographs they had, or scan those and send them to me. So there was a lot of legwork by the women that are in this book, by people that watched the women that are in this book. And in general, that was where it was easy. But as you said, going back farther in time before that, it was very, very difficult, and more so than I think when I researched for my first book, because the main topic of this book was women in hockey history, and women have in general been erased from history in a lot of different ways. The one that I found first was that when you'd get five paragraphs about a hockey game for a men's team, you would get three sentences for a women's game that happened. The other portion of that was that rarely did any article use a full name for women. Yeah. You might get an initial, but most likely it was simply last names. And then the other aspect of that was a true challenge was that you could probably find the name of a unmarried woman, but as soon as a woman was married and continued to play hockey, they would refer to, the article would refer to them, you know, as Miss James Smith.
Right.
There was no actual name for the individual that played the game. So that's where it became very, very difficult. And anytime I could find someone's full name, that was like a little gold nugget that I held on to.
Sure.
You know, if you're a Taylor Swift fan, it was the Easter egg that led me to the next clue. And that's where I really tied into things was when I could find someone's full name, I stuck with it and I dug deeper into that one individual And usually it would lead me to something else. I could find ancestry or things like that, that I could work with. But that was the biggest challenge, really, was that how we've referred to women through history, whether it's patriarchal connection to spouses, whether it was just kind of journalists that at least they wrote something about women's hockey, but there was very sparse, there was no statistic pages. All of those things were challenges. And so that slowed the process monumentally.
Yeah. I've done research in the 1930s and there are things in newspapers and then eventually on radio, the women's pages, right? Mm-hmm. Big in the papers, the women's pages, but same thing there. It's Mrs. Bill Smith, right? And so I'm like, well, who actually is this?
There were two really prominent, Myrtle Cook and Alexandrine Gibb were two spectacular women's sports journalists through the first half of the 20th century. And they were, without what they did each week in their columns, No Man's Land of Sport was Gibb's column, and In the Women's Sportlight was Cook's column. And those two were just paramount to this because those women really captured the sport. They were both incredible builders in all aspects of women's sport in Canada in particular, but North America and globally as well. And those women's columns were fascinating and invaluable. So when you do find those, that was where the real gold was.
Yeah. So how are those women, how are Myrtle Cook, Alexandra Gibbs, how are they writing about these games? Is it presented as hockey games that happen to be played by women, or are they leaning into the fact that it's women's hockey? And how does that potentially impact their place in the paper, like physically where these articles are being published?
Well, those columns were relatively prominent in the same place each time. But in general, you know, the women's hockey stories were footnotes. They were buried deep. They were afterthoughts. They were, like I said, two sentences at the end of something that had been a much more in-depth covered men's game or amateur men's game. You can feel the fact that it was an afterthought. But one of the interesting things was, until probably the Second World War, women's hockey was referred to respectfully in a lot of cases. There were definitely detractors. There were definitely those sexist, misogynist men that were reporting on it that felt that women had no place in the game. But women's hockey historically was a very physical sport. Body checking was legal until 1992, when again, men came in and decided to take it out. There was fighting. There were crowds of thousands of fans that flocked to the arenas back in 1915, back in, you know, the 30s. The arenas were sold out, and the papers would report that the women's championship games and playoff games were usually actually the highest attended games in many places. And I thought that was spectacular, the way that was covered. And definitely there were people that wrote about women's hockey as a spectacle or as something to be laughed at. But in general, many of those prominent teams had developed a following, not just from fans, but also from some media people that covered it as it should be covered. And that mostly changed as we moved into a more modern era where gender roles shifted when people returned from the war and women were expected at that point to go back to housework compared to war efforts. And it all shifted as societal expectations and norms really started to oppress women again in terms of how they could engage in sport.
I think we often take for granted sometimes when we look back on things that, well, this is the way it was, right? So you look at the NHL as the dominant league in the world, the dominant hockey league in the world. That didn't have to be the case. It turned out to be the case. And so if we go back to that interwar period, as you're mentioning, where women's hockey is drawing big crowds, it's being written about, as you say, as it's another hockey game. So I'm curious, you know, the NHL in that moment is still fledgling and still growing. New teams are coming. What is the situation in women's hockey? Are we looking at the formation or the attempted formation of a league or leagues? And what are the competitions that these women are playing in?
Well, if you go back even farther, the main original tournament was the Banff Winter Carnival, which drew many winter sports together in Western Canada. And that became a very prominent event for the top teams from Alberta, British Columbia, you know, pretty much across the prairies early on. But as it developed, there were a lot of city leagues. The Montreal City and District Hockey League was a fantastically popular league from the mid-1920s through to the start of World War II. Basically, women's hockey took a hiatus around 1939 when most things shifted, or at least leagues kind of disbanded. There were pockets here and there, but in general, there were leagues. There were provincial organizations. There was the Dominion Women's Amateur Hockey Association, which formed in 1933. And that was the first attempt to really bring together a national championship that involved everyone. It fought for a while. Quebec held out a little bit longer than most others did to join that competition. But by the time we're in the mid-1930s, we've got the Crystal Sisters from Prince Edward Island. We've got the Montreal Maroons. We've got the Edmonton Rustlers and the Calgary Crescents and Hollies and the Winnipeg Olympics and Eatons. And of course, in Ontario, probably the most famous team because they were almost unbeatable for a decade was the Preston Rivulets, who have some of the most famous women that, again, have never been recognized by the sport as they should be in halls of fame. But the Ranscombe sisters, Hilda Ranscombe in particular, was pretty much unanimously consensus that she was the best player in the world in the 1930s. But that team was filled with, there was also a sister group called the Schmucks that were fabulous again. And that it just, there's so many that we could talk about, but the organizations formed. The Ladies Ontario Hockey Association was another big one that came through and really started to organize women's hockey at a provincial level here. But they were all across Canada. There was definitely provincial organizations, but the Dominion Women's Amateur Hockey Association was the biggest, the longest running, and the most well-organized group of them all that actually was capable of bringing together a national championship for the Lady Bessborough Cup at the time.
And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the Preston Rivulets are a national historic event. They're in that register now within the last 20 years, I think that is. But
and they've been recognized by the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame. And, you know, there are individuals, including Hilda Ranscombe, who have been individually recognized as well. But yes, they are widely considered one of the most dominant hockey teams, regardless of gender, that's ever existed.
And so early on, where are the women learning the sport? And by that, I mean, what is the feeder system into these higher level teams? On the men's side, you do have the major junior level and going from the local to the more regional and then to these bigger teams. Do we see a similar system on the women's side where it's really drawing from where the teams are? And as the teams get bigger and more successful, they have essentially a larger drawing area?
No. There was no feeder system. Sorry to be so blunt on that answer, but really the truth of it is that it was only senior women's hockey, intermediate, I guess. So basically by the time you were 16 up to 40 years old, you could be in this league. But there were instances where some teams in smaller centers where they didn't have the population to draw a large team would have 11 or 12-year-old girls playing alongside the 25 to 30 year old women that are on these teams, because there was no other place to really improve your game other than outside on the ponds. And that's probably where the feeder system was for a lot of youth at the time, where, you know, Canadian hockey, American hockey all started, and European hockey on outdoor rivers and ponds and places like that, where girls would play alongside brothers, cousins, friends. It was really a kind of a communal thing. Of course, it's part of ingrained in Canadian history, and a little bit less so in American, but that's where it came. And as they got to that older age, usually in high school, that's when they started joining actual organized clubs. But there was no feeder system. There really was no pathway for girls to even see themselves entering the sport. It was frowned upon at just about every level still. Most women and girls at the time were pushed towards figure skating. And of course the skates and equipment, it was something else that was always a question. There's so many stories of girls that started playing and brought their figure skates home and had their whoever file off the picks on the front so that they wouldn't catch them while they were playing, and they could play more stylistically like hockey was done at the time. So, but yeah, there was definitely no organized youth girls hockey at the time.
And you mentioned equipment. I work part of my career now is working with the Department of National Defense in the military history of this country. And one thing that has come up recently in the dress instructions with which people I work on is equipment for women, that the standard issue equipment forever was based on a man's body. So what about equipment in this early part of the 20th century, mid 20th century? Are equipment manufacturers making things specifically for women, or are the women, as has happened so often, creating essentially their own equipment by modifying the standard issue stuff, or even in a lot of cases, perhaps making it themselves?
Well, when you go back to the earlier stages of this, there's most pictures that you can see depicted started out with very long skirts or dresses that are almost ankle length. When you move a little bit farther on, bloomers became the standard attire, and that gave, of course, a lot more mobility. But there definitely was not women's hockey equipment of any shape, form, style for many years. It wasn't until probably the mid-1990s, 95, 96, somewhere in that range. And in the book, one of the people that I've interviewed is, her name is Kelly Dyer, and she was a national team goaltender for Team USA. And she was one of the first people that recognized that all the members on her team were wearing this big boxy equipment that didn't fit their bodies. The flex on their hockey sticks was too firm to be able to get the torque to shoot a puck properly. As a goaltender, she was very aware of the different sizes of equipment that should be on her body and how pucks would hit her. So she actually started using teammates on long bus rides as models to start measuring and designing new equipment. And when she finished the 1990 and 92 World Championships, she started calling around to different equipment manufacturers looking for someone that would be interested in creating women's specific hockey equipment. Eventually she found Hillrich and Bradsby, which owned Louisville, the famous Louisville Sluggers, and of course many hockey sticks that went along with that. And they were thrilled and immediately started making a women's hockey equipment line. Their goal was to have it ready for the 1998 Olympics, because I think everyone saw that as the real financial opportunity to grow women's sports and to cash in on that investment on that equipment. And as it turns out, you know, I spoke about Marion Coveney being from Wallaceburg, Ontario. Well, the interesting part about that all with the Louisville product is that it was also manufactured in Wallaceburg, Ontario. And it just, you know, came around to here I am thinking that I'm in this little unique town out in the middle of nowhere that's got no connection to anything. And we've got that and the lipstick tournament, which launched at the centennial year in 1967, which became the first and longest ongoing and running women's hockey tournament in Ontario. And for years was the main point. It was called the North American Championships for a long time. It just all seemed to center around that one little spot on the map. And but the equipment was fascinating, where that really became something that was integral in not just the development of, not just in making women feel more comfortable, but also really improving the caliber of play. Because of course now they're, you know, you're not restricted by these big baggy hockey pants that you're using skate laces to tie up extra tight to keep them from falling down. And, you know, the shots changed dramatically as sticks were started to be manufactured for women. So, and that's still ongoing. It's really, you know, we're not talking about ancient history in this one. That is still a product and process that's developing as we speak.
Yeah, it is really, really quite remarkable that you can trace the history of sports through the equipment. And as equipment gets better and gets tailored, the athletes, it's not always the case that the athletes get better, but they are given equipment to showcase how good they've always been. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's, you see that certainly in the case of women's hockey. So now that we have talked a little bit now about the post-war period, the women who you were talking to and interviewing, what sort of headwinds were they facing through their careers in not only wanting to play, but wanting to have a bigger platform and get more games and teams and more people involved in the sport? What were some of the big themes in terms of headwinds that they talked about while they were speaking to you about their careers?
Top to bottom, there was barriers and there were obstacles to overcome. Ice time being a major one, most arenas would not allocate ice time to women. And when they did, pretty much every person that I spoke to and every team I heard of was practicing at 11:30 p.m. on a Thursday night or something like that. Or yeah, they might get a Saturday morning practice at 6 a.m. before anyone else would come. And one of the famous stories of Marion Coveney was actually her, and all of her teammates love to tell this, was they were playing a game in Hamilton, and the team ahead of them was a men's game. So of course they weren't finished. They let them run late. So the women started later. And then exactly at the time that their ice time was supposed to end, there was men waiting to come on after them. And so the Zamboni actually came on while they were still playing the game.
Jeez.
And Coveney skated after the Zamboni, jumped on it, swung her stick and told the Zamboni to get off the ice because they were going to finish their game. And, you know, that kind of restriction was real. There was no locker room facilities, not just the equipment, but the sponsorship dollars weren't there. Nobody was funding women's hockey. And when they found out that people were looking for women's hockey support, it was pretty much consistently a no. Governing bodies would not sanction events. They wouldn't support, they wouldn't fund. When the 1987 Women's World Hockey Tournament occurred, which was the first truly international attempt at a world championship, of course, the IIHF, which governed hockey at the time, wanted nothing to do with it. They were definitely not going to sanction it. It was put on by Fran Ryder and a number of other volunteers that ran that. And when it got around to 1990, there was still very little support for the first official world championships. But the biggest probably barrier was just that societal desire to exclude women. And the book really covers a lot of the paramount court cases that were involved in fighting against that, whether it was Heather Cramble in Winnipeg, or probably the most prominent one was a woman named Justine Blaney, who at 11 years old took her case all the way to the Supreme Court to be able to play boys hockey at the time because there was no girls team in her area. And eventually, many years later, and different levels of the court system, she did win her fight, and it did end that division between where women and girls could play. But it was right across the board where there's so many stories of women who had to conceal their gender. They dressed in their brother's clothes to get on the ice. They changed their names from, Cammy Granato to Cam Granato, or Justine Blaney to Justin Blaney. Abby Hoffman, who's one of the first famed girls that was made newspapers because she was playing boys hockey, just went as Ab and never told anyone that she was a girl. Her teammates didn't know until they had to check her birth certificate a second time for an event they were going to. And sure enough, somebody had missed it the first time, but they didn't miss it the second time. But those types of stories are just over and over and over until probably 1990. It really didn't change until the late 80s when some of those court cases were finally contested and won by families that just refused to not have their daughters on the ice. And it was incremental steps over time, but the barriers were, if you name it, if women faced it, it also existed in hockey, because I think sport's just a reflection of society at many times. And historically, that seems to have really stood true.
In your conversations with these women, how did they assess the impact that had on their careers? and just wanting to play. But at the same time, you have to deal with court cases and advocacy and pressuring people. When any athlete who I've ever talked to, and certainly you've talked to a lot more, given that you are a sports journalist, all they want to do is go play, right? That's really what they're wired to do. They want to go play and win. Like, that's sort of what they're wired to do. But the women who you are talking about and talking to for this book, they have this other whole giant thing they have to go through just to be able to do that. So did they comment on what impact that had, if any, on their on-ice performance or their preparation or just their careers? Did that come up at all?
Absolutely. And I think it's still something that we're discussing even in today's era of the Professional Women's Hockey League, where the idea is to make women true professionals in the sport, where they have time to train, where they have time to recover, where, you know, you play a game or a road trip on a weekend. The last thing your body wants is to wake up at 6 a.m. on Monday and go back to work and do a day job. So those were extreme considerations, not just the fact that the ice time wasn't available, but, you know, historically, when you go back, women were banned from fitness facilities, from gyms for a very long period of time. You know, there was no nutrition. There definitely wasn't proper coaching. A lot of times when teams got a good coach, it was probably someone's older brother that had grown up playing hockey and had access to proper training and drills and items like that. But the barriers were certainly there in that way. Shirley Cameron jumps out to me as a person in the book, very famous national team member from Canada, from Alberta. And, you know, she tells the story of when she wanted to go to her first national championship. She was the first woman to be a letter carrier in the city of Edmonton. And she had to basically lie and call out sick to go. And when she got to the national championship, she got interviewed by, I think it was the Toronto Star. And she said, absolutely, I'll speak to you, but please don't put my name in the paper because my boss doesn't know I'm here. And of course, you know, the headline was something like Cameron risks career to play. And she got suspended when she returned. And even though men that worked in the same job were openly given time to go and pursue their athletic dreams at a national and international level, and she didn't get that. So there was those extra stressors constantly that impacted training, where women had to, of course, wake up and go back to work or return to family obligations or whatever it might be. There really was no rest and training and fitness and nutrition, and all those aspects that men were already starting to get at that time were being massively overlooked, and to a certain extent are still, because there's many women in the Professional Women's Hockey League that when the day their season's done, they're heading home to start another job for a few months or to run hockey camps to make ends meet. And we're still getting there in that point. But it was, and it has been a significant impact to the level of play that women were able to reach because of those restrictions.
Now, you mentioned earlier the Olympic Games and the entry of women's hockey into the Olympics. I have for a long time wondered, could we not just have the United States against Canada, 7-game series in the Olympics? That's what I want to see. I, you know, my theory is that if another country can finish first or second in one of the 3 world championships leading into the Olympics, then everybody gets to play for gold. Otherwise, just give us what we want to see for now. But that's sort of the signature moment, I think, of any Winter Olympics at this point, is that gold medal game between Canada and the United States. But I'm curious, if we go back to 1998 and the entry of women's hockey into the Olympics, how was that viewed at the time broadly? Like, you've read a lot of the coverage of this, you're familiar with it. How is it covered? How is it talked about? And compare that to how the women who were playing the sport in the Olympics, how did they view it compared to the way the sports writers might have talked about it?
Well, for the women, it was the career highlight. It was the most monumental moment in the sport for women that could have been there. And that Olympic movement, even though it took until 1998, there was already people making significant pushes for the inclusion of women's hockey in the Winter Olympics in the 1930s. And it ebbed and flowed as the game itself you know, the leagues that formed and fell and rose again. But there is a lot of talk, like you say, about the parity level in women's hockey. And we don't get that same conversation in men's hockey. But I've done a lot of the historical comparisons, and the blowouts that occur in women's hockey are almost identical to the ones that occur in men's hockey. Because one of the aspects that we don't see, that we've always been able to see in men's hockey through history, is the depth of women's hockey. And when we look at the NHL and people say, well, the league is so deep, people get to know that because the league's been televised and broadcasted and written about forever. If we had always had a professional women's hockey league where the best hundreds of women from North America were able to play, and then you start bringing European players in bit by bit, we would have seen the depth of women's hockey. But 1998, you know, that was just the turning point for everything. There was an explosion of registration afterwards for girls and women. But there was international play back into the 1920s and 1930s between England and France. That was the original rivalry series between international teams. There was no Team Canada versus Team USA at that point, but there was an annual competition between teams in France and England that would play in women's hockey and play in front of 10,000 fans. So, you know, that original rivalry where the two powerhouses were playing was actually not us. And those are all the types of things that I think are really important for us to talk about, because we talk about Canada and USA as being the only key figures in the development of women's hockey. And right now they are definitely pushing it forward. But those roots of skating go back into, you know, the Netherlands and places like that several hundred years ago with women's skating. And when we go to the international play, the first international games between national teams was not Canada and the USA. So it's really important for us to look at that history and acknowledge that, yes, Canada and USA are still the most dominant. We have the best systems of development, but the other nations are really rapidly catching up, whether it's Finland or Sweden or Czechia. That's really where that group is going. And I think by the time we get to another Olympic cycle or two down, we will finally have that. The Canada or USA's will eventually start to fall here from time to time, probably not regularly, but it was viewed by women, those 98 Olympics, the women that played, as this incredible opportunity. Media coverage was very critical. They were calling for it to be removed from the games. Thankfully, that didn't happen, and the game has been allowed to develop and continue on because, you know, the Olympics have evolved. We've got breakdancing now, so it could be anything. You know, like we all have to start somewhere. The game was well developed by that point. You could have put in four more teams from Canada and USA if you wanted to, and had shown the real depth of women's hockey at the time. But of course, you know, in those big team sports, it's one team per country.
It's always kind of surprised me that the Netherlands has never been big into hockey, given how much they love speed skating. So, I mean, there's an infrastructure of arenas and ice, and they make skates, different skates, obviously. But that one's always struck me as being a little strange that the Dutch don't really embrace the full hockey, right?
Like that 1987 tournament, they were there. They were one of the nations that was involved in that very first international competition, but it fell very quickly after that. And really, you know, they definitely have national teams now that compete at the lower levels. But yeah, I agree. Everything's there. Same with Norway. Why don't we have, you know, Norway should be a powerhouse in this right now. And but, you know, the winter sport focus there is more broad than it is here.
Yes. Well, yeah. Well, when you can get, at least in Norway, when pretty much anywhere in the country, you can get up into the mountains and ski and do all that. And people do that. So I'm curious to looking at this from a historical perspective, the PWHL, because you mentioned that a lot of the development is because there hasn't been this central, like big, clearly defined, this is the best league in the world for women to come play in. And that's what the PWHL, I'm not versed enough to know if that is the case, if it is clearly the best league in the world right now, but that's certainly what its goal is to have women from around the world, the best players all together in this league. And having written this book, having talked to so many of the now retired players, and I'm sure still active players, can you put the league into some historical context and what this moment is from an outsider perspective, seems like the first year went well, that it was successful. It met their goals, and looking forward to the start of the next season here. And I'm somewhere where there is a team, so I'm able to go and really follow along a home team. But from this historical perspective, what does the success of this league to this point really tell us about the evolution of women's hockey that you've traced in the book?
Well, leagues, again, have been around forever. They've risen, they've fallen, but the criticism that goes along with that rise and fall of women's sports has been distinctly different than that in men's. We can look back historically in the NHL with the WHA coming in and challenging, taking players. And so, you know, the last several years where there's been all this division in women's hockey between the PWHPA, which was the Professional Women's Players Hockey Association, and the Premier Hockey Federation, the PHF, which was the other section of professional women's players in North America. That divisiveness has been played up a lot. It was definitely real. It did exist. There was a lot of infighting and there was a lot of struggle, but the goal of creating this league was common. It was something that everyone has been looking for decades, to have one singular place for the best women in the league to be. Speaking to the leader of the PWHL right now, Hockey Hall of Famer Gina Hefford, who I interviewed for the book as well, you know, she referred to herself watching that 1990 first World Championships as a singular event in her life that meant a lot to encouraging her to continue on in hockey. And then she discussed the importance of 1998 as this watershed moment where registration spiked across the globe in women's and girls hockey. And she brought up and connected those significant events to the launch of the PWHL, because I think that we are all going to see that historically, the way that this league was covered, the way that it was attended, the television, the media, the radio, everything was there. The marketing, I mean, just the fact that we're seeing on social media all of these really professionally put together clips and reels, and everything that was there, the photography that was there was professional for once. And she referred to it, and I completely agree, that this launch of this league is going to have a greater impact than any singular event, including 1990, including 1998, that's ever existed. And that's really, really exciting. It just seems to be this moment where, you know, year one, we saw every professional women's hockey attendance record fall. Yeah. Those are historic moments. There's no going around that in any way. As soon as you start breaking record after record, week after week, you know that you're at an event that is going to be looked at as extremely significant in history. And I think that's it. And the book itself, I actually had it pretty much done by the time the PWHL was announced, which threw a little wrench in things, because I obviously had to go back and do some revisions. But we decided to end it at puck drop of season one, between Toronto and New York at Mattamy Arena, which of course is the former Maple Leaf Gardens. But that was a logical spot, I think, to end it, because it felt like the closing of a very important long chapter in women's history, in women's hockey history, where that struggle and the barriers and all of these things that we've already discussed had come through 130 years to be at this one drop of the puck. And then I'm really hopeful now that we are at the very beginning of a next chapter of important history for women in hockey, because now we're seeing women hired in NHL roles as coaches, as general managers. And I think that all of these women that are coming through this league are going to continue on to have impacts in hockey history as well, by taking off-ice roles and development roles. And so this is really that catalyst moment where everything that we know from before is definitely before. Mm-hmm. And the history that comes from this moving forward is going to be fascinating and different than anything we've seen before.
Absolutely. And if you want to get a sense of what that before was like and put what's going on into context, but also just the story of women women's hockey and women in hockey. Really well done. It is Ice in Their Veins, Women's Relentless Pursuit of the Puck. Ian, if people want to pick up a copy of the book, keep up with all the things you got going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
There are so many ways. Go to your local independent bookstore is my first one always. I love to support local independent bookstores. So jump out into whatever one is in your town. They probably have it. And if they don't, they'll order one for you and it will be there soon. Otherwise, if you're in Canada, you know, Chapters, Indigo, in the United States, you can go to Barnes & Noble, or you can go to Amazon.com. Or if you really want to support another independent organization, you can go to my publishing company, which is tidewaterpress.ca. They're in British Columbia, and just a wonderful group of people that are seeking to create pathways to tell these untold stories. So you can get it anywhere you get your books, and I would love to hear the feedback from anybody that does read it. And I would love to see the history that you get inspired to search up yourself.
And we will link down in the show notes to the Tidewater Press version. The big people, if you're going to go through the big people, you can find them. They're the big people. But we will link in the show notes to Tidewater Press. So Ian Kennedy, again, congrats on the book. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So there you have it. My conversation with Ian Kennedy, and I thank him for his time. And again, the book, Ice in Their Veins, Women's Relentless Pursuit of the Puck. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from today from the Canadian Press. I'm using the CBC version, entitled Six PWHL Teams to be Added to EA Sports Video Game NHL 25 to be released December the 5th, in which the article goes through how Electronic Arts, the maker of the NHL video games, is including the PWHL and its players in the new NHL 25. This is a significant breakthrough for the league. People can play as PWHL teams in the Play Now, Online Versus, Shootout, and Season modes. Plus, there will be a Championship Walter Cup in the game. You can create your own PWHL player. This is a really cool step in the progress, in the progression of women's hockey, that it's going to be featured in the game. In NHL 22, there were playable women's teams for the first time through the IIHF. But this now is just that next step in that process. Certainly hockey video games, sports video games have been around for a very long time. I grew up playing them, but there were no options to play as women. When I was growing up, there were no women represented in the game. So this is now part of the process, part of that evolution of women's sports. So it is very cool to see that the PWHL will be represented in the game. Very much a milestone. And even if you aren't somebody who ever played video games or plays video games now, I think that you can see that having these teams in this game, having the opportunity for everyone, and especially young girls and young women, to play as these teams, play as these players in a game, really is a very cool moment for inclusivity, representation, but also just acknowledging this talent and skill that is on display in the PWHL, which again kicks off in just over 2 weeks from now. So today's historical headline of the week from the Canadian Press: six PWHL teams added to EA Sports video game NHL 25 to be released December the 5th. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your shows. Like, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. Lots of great written material over there in the past week. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's oldest news at gmail.com. So with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old is New.